Cindy changed her name, unlisted her phone number, and moved from Vancouver to Richmond. But no matter what she did, the harassment continued.
This is probably the most baffling case that I've ever come across. One that's kept me awake at nights. I know anybody who's come across this case, the jurors, the coroner's people, police officers who I've talked to, everybody has lain awake at night thinking, can this be? Can somebody have done this to themselves? Can somebody be out there lurking still and have never been caught?
They will be trying to find out if she was murdered or if she committed suicide.
The question is, how do you tie your hands behind your own back and then kill yourself?
And they're willing to keep investigating, but I don't think they're ever going to find a killer. I now believe it's a suicide.
I believe it's a murder, yes.
We are back again to talk about Cindy James. Where we left off last time, she had disappeared. It was May 25th, 1989. And 2 weeks later, Gordon Starchuk, who was a city worker that did paving work, on June 8th, 1989 to be exact, he discovered Cindy's body in the backyard of an abandoned house located at 8111 Blundell Road. She was hogtied with a rope and face down in like a kind of half fetal position. There was again a black nylon tied around her neck, and she was partially concealed with some blackberry bushes. They also found on a fuel tank on the property some graffiti in orange reading, "Some bitch died here." There was a line sprayed on the ground from the fuel tank to her body, and inside the abandoned house there was some more graffiti just reading, "Devil." According to Gordon Starchuk, her face was black due to decomposition, and he noted maggots coming from her face and neck. There was one hand under her body and one hand was tied. Now, he assumed at the time that she must have been hogtied and that the rope had broken when she was dumped there. He called a newspaper before calling the police because he felt that this whole thing was a police conspiracy. But I don't really understand that, because until she was killed, no one really knew her story, and he said that her face was black and he couldn't make out who it was. So even if he had heard about her story on the news, like, how did he make the connection that it was her? So we either have to take Gordon's recollection with a grain of salt, or that he considered a lot of things to be a police conspiracy. There was a lot of talk about the body basically being in the open on the side of a busy road with lots of foot traffic. But news footage that I've watched shows that her body was being removed from a very densely wooded area at the back of this house with a lot of overgrown grass. So yes, the road is really busy, but the house is abandoned and kind of faced like sideways to the road. It was also a bit of an eyesore. So driving past, your vision would have been more drawn to the house than really the trees in the back. And the only reason Gordon found her was because he went back there to have a pee. Apparently there was a squatter living in the house who didn't discover the body for 2 weeks. All of Cindy's family and Ozzy immediately believed that she had been murdered, and Ozzy hypothesized that her body was actually dumped there just before she was found and that she had been killed somewhere else. And he went so far as to put pig meat in the place where Cindy had been found, and it was quickly devoured by rats and flies. So he had felt that showed that his dumping theory was correct. But where had she been killed? And she was decomposing. So normally if you keep a body before dumping it, this is just an out loud theory. I don't actually know about keeping bodies, but if you do keep a body before dumping it, you would think that you would wrap it or freeze it or something, because having a rotting corpse around is a bit much. And then when you go to pick it up and moving, well, it's gross and it's messy and things kind of slough off of it. So anyways, Dr. Sheila Carlisle was the pathologist who examined Cindy's body at the scene, and she noted that her hands had been bound so tightly that one finger had scratched another finger down to the bone. However, it doesn't note that the hands were actually tied up at the time that she was discovered. So they could have been tied very tightly at one point, and then, like Gordon said, the rope broke later. She also found a pinprick that was consistent with a hypodermic needle in her inner right elbow. Forensic entomologist Gail Anderson, she examined larvae and insect activity and concluded that her body had begun to decompose at that site where it was found as early as June 2nd. Now, to me, science wins on this one. I do not think that she was dumped. I think that she died where she was found. A toxicology on her blood found morphine, diazepam, and flurazepam in her system. And based on her stomach contents, the toxicologist was Heather Dinn. She wrote in her report that she had orally ingested between 20 to 30 milligrams of flurazepam tablets, which is like 80 pills. And that was in addition to the diazepam and morphine that was in her system. They weren't able to determine how she had actually ingested those drugs, whether it was by needle or if she'd taken them orally. Dr. John McNeil, he also looked at the toxicology report and found that there were traces of morphine in her stomach, but that could have been the result of taking it by needle as well. And if that's how it got there, then she would have been unconscious in like minutes and death within like an hour. So basically they concluded that the overdose of drugs she had in her system was, quote, so large that there was no reliable estimate of how long Cindy could have remained functional, end quote. At her memorial service that was held on June 14th, the RCMP did attend that, and they used hidden cameras to record all of the faces and the license plates of those that had attended it. Markedly absent was Roy Makepeace.
Find all your 4th of July needs at low prices, all in the Kroger app. Get USDA Choice bone-in tender ribeye steaks for $7.99 a pound with a digital coupon. Limit 5, then buy 2, get 3 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And the RCMP came out with this statement. Richmond RCMP at this point in the investigation do not suspect foul play in the death of Cindy James. Due to the possibility of an inquest being held, RCMP are unable to release any further details. Now, Ozzy and Cindy's family were pissed. Ozzy actually went to the morgue to examine her body on the 10th of June, and he found lividity on the left side of her body, but she had been found lying on her right side. So in his opinion, she had to have been dumped where she was found, and he couldn't understand why on earth they could have concluded that her death was essentially a suicide, which was what he was getting from their RCMP statement. And there was, in fact, an inquest held into her death, the longest and most expensive to date in BC's history. So it started in 1990 in Burnaby. There were 5 jurors and 80 witnesses called to get to the bottom of what had happened to Cindy. Over the 40 days that this inquest was held, they heard the 2 phone messages that Roy had managed to record. So it doesn't sound like Cindy ever did get an answering machine to document the calls. Now, I played for you earlier the one call that I was able to find, but since then I was able to find the second calls, so I'm just going to play that for you now.
No more deal.
Now, Roy testified as well. He was very sure that it was the mafia still, and that Cindy's father had been abusive to her and that the police had tried to frame him, like frame Roy. But he was adamant that he had nothing at all to do with her being terrorized and then possibly murdered. Cindy had only been 19 when she was married to him, and he was almost 40, but they had been married for like 16 years, and he describes the marriage as a happy one. He felt that it was preposterous that the police had continued to go after him, and that Cindy had what he called a hostage personality, which I think is what we would now call victim mentality. He came off as a little bit testy, if not kind of downright angry. Constable Valen Wolikoff, he testified that he had attended the first scene when she was found in that garage, and that the patterns of the wounds she had that were found at the scene were not consistent with an attacker. He's saying that, quote, some of the 14 wounds were in a pattern and would have taken 10 to 15 minutes to inflict. But the lawyer for Cindy's family, who was on the side of murder, being the her cause of death, said that it was ridiculous that it would take a minute for each wound. He also testified that she had taken 2 polygraph tests and failed both of them, which is strange that they could even bring up polygraph testing at an inquest. Like, if you can't bring them up at a criminal trial, I'm not really sure why you can at a coroner's inquest. And from the perspective of a victim, Roy felt that all of this talking about it possibly being him and blaming Cindy for it was all defamation. But he also felt that he himself was being followed and threatened, and that he had been getting calls as well, which of course he did record the two of them. Those two were directed at Cindy, although the second one maybe wasn't directed at Cindy. Maybe it was directed at him. So he said that he was as afraid of afraid as well of what was happening to Cindy, that he was also then going to be attacked as well. Now, Roy said he also had gotten threats from some of his patients, so he felt that whoever this was had to be one of the parents of one of the kids that she worked with back at Bellum House, and again, that they had been tied to the mafia. Now, he had an alibi for a lot of the incidents, particularly the fire that broke out at Cindy's, that Agnes, that both Agnes and Cindy referred to as a firebomb, but investigators felt had started from pouring an accelerant inside the house. So Roy was actually in South Africa during that time. And in the incident where the note had been stabbed through her hand, the officer that testified about that scene said that he found it odd that there was no blood on her clothing, and the blood on the floor didn't look so much like a cleanup, but more like something had been bloodied and then smeared around. But the results of the polygraph that she took regarding that incident showed that she was telling the truth. Agnes Woodcock testified that she had once been in the living room with Cindy when the alarm went off at her place and they found that a window had been tampered with. And then there was another time that she had used the phone and everything was fine, but then she went to use it again that same night and the phone lines had been cut. And she testified that after the fire that Cindy had at her place, Cindy had said to Agnes, "I never thought he would do anything while you folks were with me." She also testified that she had become despondent and had stopped eating and felt pretty hopeless. There was testimony from a number of psychiatrists, including Dr. Marcus, who had examined her after the fire incident. Now, he felt that she had this DID, or dissociative identity disorder. And he said, quote, "This woman was under siege from whatever source, inside or out. She was in a living nightmare," end quote. But he also testified that she had this inordinate need for attention and recognition and is incapable of doing things honestly. However, this was the same psychiatrist that Constable Carroll, who's that female officer that believed the men on the force were basically being hoodwinked by this pretty girl. He's the one that she was asked to examine Cindy, and he never asked her any questions about her childhood, about any trauma that she might have suffered. Oh, and this Mr. Marcus, he also worked with Roy at the university, so they knew each other, and Roy by that time was pretty furious that Cindy was accusing him of harassing her, so he was telling people then that he believed that she was staging it to make Roy look bad. So he kind of contradicts himself as well, that he believes that she was being stalked and that he was too, and that he was in danger. But then he's telling other people that, no, she thinks she's staging it all. So I don't know. That's just kind of weird to me. Dr. Marcus had also spoken to the media about Cindy, which is a bit of a no-no in psychiatry, and he revealed that Cindy had told him that Roy had plans to make this impenetrable fortress as a way of getting even with those that had wronged him. I'm not sure, based on some of this stuff, that I would really find Dr. Marcus a very reliable witness, but whatevs, as they say. He conceded that somebody, maybe Cindy herself or someone else, was determined to ruin Cindy's life and drive her to suicide. Now, Dr. Paul Termanson, he believed that she had hysterical personality disorder. Dr. Wesley Friesen said that no, it was borderline personality disorder with PTSD. His theory was that Cindy had a lot of anger towards her father, whom he felt had sexually abused her, although Cindy never once said that about her dad. Now, what's interesting is that I couldn't find any reporting that Dr. Alan Connolly, who was her treating psychologist over the years, who worked with Cindy and believed her, testified at all. The mountain climber, rope and knot expert testified as well. He was Robert Chisnell was his name. Now, this time he was able to demonstrate how she could have tied herself in 3 minutes, which is when the effects of the drug, they think, kind of would have started to take effect if she had done this to herself. Cindy's diaries never revealed anything that hinted that she was making anything up. She wrote about her fears and how it was taking over her life. She couldn't relax, she couldn't sleep, and it was just all consuming. And that she was frustrated with the police, that, you know, the fact that they didn't believe her. But there were no hints that she had any kind of mental issues, just that she was going through this unbelievable trauma and fear. But she did once write about the hypnosis memory, that she wished she knew if it was real or just a dream. So to me, that's a good thing. It's showing that she's like, well, she's showing a little bit of doubt in the whole hypnosis thing, which of course I find just to be a bunch of baloney, which is my opinion, not necessarily yours. In probably some of the most damning to Cindy's credibility was a search of Cindy's house, found a bit of a hoard of drugs, including sedatives and some antipsychotics, but they were all prescribed to her by various psychiatrists over the year. Now, Melanie Hack, who's her younger sister, she admitted to finding a glass cutter in her purse, which, to be fair, might have been one of those ones that you're supposed to carry if you ever need to punch the glass out in your car. She also found a syringe kit, a catheter, and a bag of saline solution in her bedroom. She was a nurse, so she would have had easy access to those things. However, Ozzy testified that he believed her very, very much. He at least believed that all of the incidents were real. He says that he was there, he investigated, and he knew her and her reactions, spent a lot of time around her, and that all of these incidents were very real. The hypnotist also testified that her memories were real, but again, I'm going to skip over that because I just think the whole thing is just hogwash. I just think she should have never been encouraged to do any of that. I think it just destroyed her credibility. But the question of how Cindy managed to leave the car, walk to the abandoned house, write some graffiti, and then tie herself up, like hog tie herself, and then shot herself up with a lethal dose of morphine in her system, and all without leaving any like vials or whatever are laying around. She also had been found in her bare feet, and the bottoms of her feet were clean. Like, she hadn't walked there. And the drugs that she had overdosed with, they weren't drugs that were found in this collection or that she had been prescribed for anything. Like, all of the drugs that were found in her house were prescriptions to her, but the drugs that she was, what was found in her system after she died, none of those had been prescribed to her. And with all of that testimony and whatnot, the inquest jury found on May 25th, 1990, so exactly 1 year after she had disappeared, that Cindy Hack Maypeace James had died of an unknown event, and they could not determine conclusively if it had been a suicide, a homicide, or an accident. And for the next 40 years, podcasters, documentarians, writers, journalists, and web sleuths went insane with their theories and whatnots. Oh, and there's a couple of extra things that I found in my research. The alarm company, the one that Cindy had installed in her homes, the stickers on the doors and windows, I noticed in some of the old footage, all said Caban Alarm Systems. So it seems like Aussie Caban might have made a little bit of a profit off of Cindy's fears. Like, I'm not saying it says anything about like who did it, what, when, or any of those things, but I did find it a bit interesting that nobody had reported on that. And also there was this interview that I saw on Crime Beat with one of her former co-workers who came to visit her while she was in Riverview, which is the psychiatric hospital she was in. Now, she felt that she had what looked like split personality and remembered this time when she ran into her, which she was out shopping and she had bought clothes that she would never normally wear. She didn't seem to remember a conversation that they'd had just a couple of days before. She described her as appearing manic. But it should be mentioned that this particular coworker, although she really liked Cindy, was a big believer in the DID theory. And I'm not sure if you remember or not, but that book, When Rabbit Howls by Trudy Chase, it came out in 1987. She was on Oprah, and I think they made a movie about her life. She had DID, like the classic case where all the personalities are very distinct. Anyways, I don't know if you remember that or not, but it was kind of like, it was like the satanic panic around then. Suddenly, like, everyone had DID. And then on the other side, there were people that said it was all fake. There's no such thing. Anyways, it was really a thing back then, and I think you just need to kind of keep that in mind about the time period we're talking about. But also, in 2003, it was revealed that Roy Makepeace, who, remember, not only lived with Cindy for years and years and was a psychiatrist and an academic and always believed, you know, someone was after Cindy and himself. Well, he used to work with a Dr. James Tyhurst. Now, Tyhurst was a psychiatrist at the University of British Columbia. And what do you ask, does this guy have to do with Cindy's story? Well, on Crime Beat, there was this little short little mention of him having worked with Roy and that he was years later up on criminal charges that, and he also had a cabin out at Gabrielle Island. And could this somehow be connected to her hypnosis theory? So I decided to look into this little blurb of information that I found in passing, which I don't like to take information too much from Crime Beat, which is overseen by Global, not because I don't believe them or that they're not factual, but Global News is super protective of their research and information. Like, they might be pulling court documents and all that stuff, which is public information, but do not piggyback off of that. Get your own documents, that kind of thing. But I actually can't believe that they just kind of skimmed over this little tidbit, because it's actually very interesting as far as a theory maybe on what could have happened to Cindy. So Global, I did my own research. So there. So back in 1981, a complaint by a woman just known as EW came before the Ethic Committee of the College Council complaining that Dr. Tyhurst asked Miss EW to sign this indenture agreement, which is basically just a contract, but that he had been treating her in a very subservient way and that at times during her therapy she was forced to be undressed. Now, Dr. Tyhurst's response was that she was seriously disturbed and had a personality disorder, including a lack of self-discipline, and was suffering from obesity. But he said that he would stop this particular type of therapy and that he only asked her to get undressed so that he could take her measurements because of this obesity that she was suffering from, and that seeing the measurements would give her this self-discipline. Okay, but nudity isn't really part of psychotherapy. And why did you restrain her in like a bondage-like way? Well, that, he said, it was because she was very disturbed. She needs restraints. It totally wasn't sexual. So the council wrote him a strong letter that his methods were not acceptable and that next time he should probably consult with another doctor before doing that. And this contract that she had signed was a one-year contract that said that she consented to obeying without conditions or reservations his orders and instructions, and failure to comply would mean that she would be returned to the corrections authorities. So this woman was obviously under some kind of court order to undergo this therapy. And she had unwittingly fell into the hands of this controlling pig of a therapist. He also took pictures of her, which he defended as being part of this therapy. But the university never followed up to make sure he wasn't doing it anymore. So then a woman known as AC came forward to the university that she had been a patient of Dr. Tyhurst from 1966 to 1975, and that his treatment was to make her his slave and him her master, and that he would make her stand or sit or kneel, well, topless, and then whip her while her arms and legs were chained, and that these sessions would be at her home, and that he often made her perform oral sex on him. And one time had her come out to his cottage at Gabriella Island to lay nude together. Ugh. And then another woman, J.G., said that between 1979 and 1988, that's a particularly interesting time period, she was treated in a similar way. And then a third woman. And again, the University Ethics Committee interviewed Dr. Tyhurst, and this time he said, it got out of hand, it got carried away. Anywho, after 10 years of these complaints and four women finally managed to get criminal charges laid against him, and he was found guilty and sentenced to 4 years in prison, but was out on bail to await his appeals. Quote, the disclosure that the College of Physicians and Surgeons let him off with a warning 10 years ago contradicts the college's claim that for years it has exercised zero tolerance for sexual abuse by doctors. Anyways, he denied all of it and said that all of the women were borderline psychotics living in a world of unreality, and you couldn't believe a word that they had to say, even though they were all telling the same story but didn't know each other. Now, one of the women filed a civil suit against him in 1990, and he was ordered to pay her $556,000, but he was 80 at the time. In her lawsuit, she said that she was ordered to strip naked at least once and to strip to her waist on numerous occasions while Dr. Tyhurst whipped her. She was also required to kneel, crawl, and serve him, call him master, and kiss his hands and feet. In her contract, it said that she had contracted to be willing to commit myself to being a slave, which includes total obedience, accountability, a submissive attitude, and taking punishment quietly. I realize I need to be made to submit to orders so that I don't avoid or procrastinate commitment. Until I learn more self-discipline, I need to have external discipline. All very interesting. Like, could Cindy have discovered Dr. Tyhurst's disgusting little secret? Could she have been a patient of Dr. Tyhurst? I don't think it's out of the question that Roy would have referred her to one of his colleagues for treatment. Not that, like, he knew what this Dr. Tyhurst was doing, but, you know, sometimes you have a friend or a family member and you say, like, oh, yeah, here's a good doctor that you should go to. And it's not impossible that she could have been a patient of his. So anyways, I think that all sounds very fishy that this pig worked with Roy. I don't think that Roy was a pig as well, but they did know each other. And I think that the timing of Cindy's issues and what this guy was doing, it's possible that she could have stumbled upon this dirty little secret and threatened to be this whistleblower. It's just interesting. It's something to keep in mind there. Okay, so we have officially now gone through everything. We are done with the story part, and we can now move on to some of the theories. And then me, who has, of course, solved this whole thing, maybe. But sorry, that's going to have to wait till episode 5. Yes, it's going to take me a whole episode to get through all of the theories. So I'm going to be back again next week with the conclusion of the case of Cindy James. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. By honoring your sacred vocation of business, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. At Grand Canyon University, our MBA degree program is 100% online, with emphases in business analytics and finance to help you reach your goals. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.